It's the confluence where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. The county executive appoints an advisory group on lead while the controller wants a moratorium on partial lead line replacements. We'll discuss that later in the program, but first, the Pennsylvania primary is over. No real big surprises, but less than 24 hours after the polls closed in the primary, another candidate jumped into one of the big races for next year. In studio, we have Chris Potter, reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Chris, welcome back to the show.
Good to be here as always.
And we also want to welcome Kevin Zwick, reporter for the Greensburg Tribune Review. Kevin, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Okay. If you have a question or comment, please tweet us. Use the hashtag WESAConfluence. So Bill Peduto pulls in nearly 69% of the vote Tuesday to win the Democratic nomination for a second term. And a much easier win than 4 years ago when he was challenged by Jack Wagner and Jake Wheatley.
And they said it pretty resoundingly clear. They want to see a mandate to continue our push to reform city government, to modernize and invest into not only the brick and mortar of City Hall, but the people who work there as well.
All right. We'll start with you, Chris. Mandate, like the mayor says?
Yeah, I think absolutely. Even as late as Election Day, I was hearing some people who were skeptical or critical of the mayor saying, well, if he can't pull this, if he can't get over 60%, because everybody knew he was going to win, but so there's this threshold. If he can't get over 60%, it's a sign of weakness. And obviously, as you said, he did that and then some on top of that. So I think the mayor has a pretty solid argument for, hey, people liked what I was doing, and I'm going to continue to do it. That's the message I expected to hear from him on Tuesday evening, and that's the one we got.
All right. You mentioned that 60% threshold. Mm-hmm. Got 69%. John Welsh, about 17.5%. Darlene Harris, 13.2%. Any surprise at their finish 2 and 3?
Yeah, I know some people who are a little surprised to see that Darlene Harris, who's a pretty well-established name in Pittsburgh politics over the years, finishing last in this race. I'm not so surprised. I was generally impressed with the campaign Reverend Welch put on. It felt like an actual campaign. There were lawn signs and T-shirts and campaign rallies and press conferences. He did the things that a candidate is supposed to do, and Darlene Harris never really did. And a big part of the reason for that, we found out, as I reported in early May, was she had no money. She raised $0 between January and the first couple days of May. And I think she just never had the ability to put together any of the trappings of a conventional campaign. And Reverend Welch did. And I thought he did. I thought he was a strong spokesman for a point of view. And I think he did a credible job for a first time candidate.
And you heard him the evening of the primary saying that he thought he did a pretty good job. He was overall pleased with his performance and said, you haven't heard the last of me.
That's right. And I suspect that's true. And of course, he is, you know, he sort of comes from a faith tradition that is very much about bearing witness to the things that you believe in. So I don't know exactly what form his advocacy will take, but I would be surprised if we didn't hear more from him in one respect or another.
Okay, I want to get a couple more questions about the city politics. Then we want to go state in 2018 and bring Kevin Zwick into the conversation. But there were no Republicans on the ballot. No surprise there.
Right.
But I believe there were 714 write-in votes in the mayoral primary in the Republican category. Do we know? Well, let me ask it this way. Do we know if Mayor Peduto did a sort of quiet campaign for write-in among some maybe GOP friends so he could lock down both?
Yeah, I don't know that. And I haven't asked. I've actually when it comes to Republican write-ins, perhaps the race to sort of watch there is on the sheriff's side. There were about 4,200 write-ins cast in the sheriff's race, which is between Bill Mullen, the incumbent, and George Sattler, a Pittsburgh homicide detective who is also a first-time candidate. It is clear to me, based on just sort of things that I heard and conversations with the Sattler campaign, George Sattler was out there trying to develop people getting, you know, writing his name in. So it takes a few weeks usually for the disposition of these write-ins to be known. It would not surprise me at all if George Sattler would be in a position to challenge Bill Mullen again in November, though I it's a little hard for me to imagine that getting him anywhere. So I'm not aware on the city side. I just haven't asked. I mean, it's generally a foregone conclusion in Pittsburgh since 1930, right, whatever, that if you win the primary, you're going to be the guy in
33, in Charles Klein, yeah, last Republican to be elected.
Very. Yeah, I'll tell you what, not for nothing are you moderating this show, buddy.
But the point is I believe you need 200, minimum 250 write-ins to actually get a nomination. Of course, have the largest number.
Right. Exactly. Okay. So, yeah, you basically the floor is you kind of have to get as many write-ins as you would have needed to be written to be on the ballot in the first place, and then be the top vote getter.
All right. So let's jump ahead. Why not jump ahead a year? Let's forget about November for now. York County millionaire business owner running for governor. Where have we heard this story before, Kevin Zwick?
Well, the governor himself.
Yes.
It's the thing about this this next election. I'm going to say there's two words for 2018, and it's going to be mucho dinero. Mm. There's going to be lots of money at play. You have two millionaires. You have the governor, and you have Scott Wagner. And then you have Paul Mango, who just announced the other night,
right,
who some of his people close to him are saying that he's willing to put in a couple million also over the course of the primary. We don't really know if he's how much, you know, if he's an actual millionaire, quote, right, unquote, or not, but... it's going to be a lot of money thrown into this race coming up.
All right. So Scott Wagner was the first GOP candidate to declare. I think it was around January. Sometime.
Yeah.
He at least has some name recognition. He is a state senator from York County, and he owns a trash hauling business,
yes,
I believe,
yes,
it is.
Okay.
Yes. Who is Scott Wagner? For people in the western part of the state, we don't often know,
sure,
people from, you know, a little bit east of us.
Yeah, I mean, Scott Wagner is a first term state senator, but he came in as one of the, I think, the only write-in victory for a state legislative office holder.
So it can work.
Yeah, right there. Yeah, yeah. And then so he's also, before he got into the Senate, he was kind of a prolific donor to Republican and conservative causes. So he's known in those circles. He's also picked a lot of fights with public sector unions in Harrisburg. So that's kind of got his name out around, just even maybe in a not so flattering way, but he's endeared himself to the conservative activists across the state. He's got on some of the labor people, the public sector labor people aren't so happy with him. So his name's got out one way or another.
Chris?
Yeah, the other thing that he's done very successfully is he basically chaired the state Republican Senate committee's efforts to build on their majority there and was very successful at it. So he has, in a very short period of time, I would say, built up a lot of us rank and file voters may not have heard of him. But amongst those voters who kind of helped set the shape the landscape for the primary, he has got quite a bit of cachet.
Yeah, and he's also, as before he even ran the campaign committee, he personally donated to a few now Senate Republicans. Mm-hmm. So he also has a few in his pocket in Harrisburg. And when he first came in, he also made a name for himself, at least in the political circles, because he led a charge basically to oust a more moderate Senate Majority Leader from Delaware County. And then he also famously said he would sit in the back of the legislative chamber with a baseball bat when votes were being taken. So that kind of he got his.
That
got
actually
his name
hasn't
out.
Happened for
no,
the record.
No, has no, it? I have. Okay. I've sat in the chamber a few times, but I have not seen him in the back with a baseball bat.
All right. So he's admitted, Wagner, that he's running sort of an outsider platform, that popular term, outsider, such as President Trump.
Well, I guess, yeah, you can say that. I think Wagner was Trump before Trump, actually.
Yes.
I mean, like, he's not polished, but he's not one that really tries to polish what he's going to say. He speaks his mind, you know, in a way. I mean, Chris, want to jump in on that?
There's this already a sort of celebrated incident where he had one of these campaign trackers, a guy with a video camera who kind of follows candidates around, and Senator Wagner didn't think the tracker should be there and announced, you're about to see your senator in action.
Yes. As he removed the microphone from his lapel and sort of charged to the back of the room. And
yeah. So
was, yeah.
So it's interesting. And then the contrast, which is notable, because this Paul Mango guy, one might expect also a sort of businessman outsider running, and also kind of helping his campaign, is David Urban, the guy who was the sort of field marshal for Donald Trump's himself's campaign in Pennsylvania last year. But Mango is a much different, at least so far, to the extent that we know much about him, much different guy, a much more subdued presentation,
yeah,
and
yeah.
doesn't have the same kind of, you know, with Wagner, he's sort of an outsider in terms of style, but he's been playing an inside game in terms of building up goodwill within his party. Mango is basically an unknown quantity. While he's given money to Republican causes, it's mostly been at the national level. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until a month or two ago that he started really dropping some money.
$25,000 to the state Republican Party, and then also donations to Chester County GOP party, who's the former chair of Chester County, who's now current state Republican chair.
We're talking about the 2017 and even more so about the 2018 elections with Chris Potter, reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, and also Kevin Zwick. He is a reporter for the Greensburg Tribune Review. You mentioned Paul Mango from this area. You both covered his announcement Wednesday evening at the Soldiers and Sailors Memorial Hall. Let's hear a little bit from him.
The fundamental role of government in the 21st century is not to deliver all of these services, but to engage the relevant groups in the community, then to stimulate innovation among them by inviting collaboration with private enterprise.
Okay, first of all, the setting, Soldiers and Sailors. He pointed out he's a West Point grad. What's the essence of that message, that just that little tidbit of a message right there?
I asked one of an aide before the event, and I said, gee, is the military background going to play into this campaign at all? And he just sort of, yeah, of course it is. It's, you know, Soldiers and Sailors, you know, stored, you know, military national museum. And he, you know, his slogan is ready to serve. I mean, and he has on his, I put in my story, you know, his website, it says his recruitment center for volunteers where you can enlist with his campaign. So he's really going. And that's the thing, is it's probably going to be, if as he's introducing himself across the state, I think one of the things he's going to obviously rely on is military background, which will separate him from the rest of the field. Because as of right now, I'm fairly like 98% sure that none of them have other like military background, unless you're wrong on that. I shouldn't have went there.
I think Chris is going to take the under on
percentage. Quick, check Google.
So a little bit more about who this. You said we didn't know who he was. He was until fairly recently the principal of the business management consulting firm McKinsey & Company. Mm-hmm. So he's a management consultant. That is his profession.
Healthcare systems management consultant. So,
right. Okay. He said the fundamental purpose of government is not to deliver services, quote, but to engage the relevant groups in the community and to stimulate innovation among them by inviting collaboration with private enterprise, end quote. That is sort of a fiscal conservative kind of message.
I'll confess, I have a hard time knowing exactly what that means. And I'm just not sure to the extent. I got sort of the sense that he sort of imagined sort of devolving power down to a more local level. There was a bit of talk about doing more of that stuff, but it's very difficult at this point to say from a policy standpoint what. And of course, there's a lot of time. We're talking 2018 here, but. You know, and he's sort of introducing himself, but I'm somebody, I tend to be sort of a substance guy. I want to know kind of like what your, give me at least a framework to understand your policy. And there was none of that there. And in fact, he did not take questions from press, which is something candidates typically do when they kick off. You know, there's a bit of give and forth. And essentially he was kind of, his staff kind of set up a phalanx around him and hustled him past us. So there are a lot of questions in my mind about kind of what that stuff really means on the ground in terms of policy, and that's what we'll have to find out.
That brings us to, is expected too strong of a word, but I'll use it in this case, another candidate, Mike Terzai, the Speaker of the Pennsylvania House. Supposed to make a decision after the budget. Is that what we're hearing? What?
Sometime in the summer. He's quote-unquote strongly considering. So
I don't think there's much doubt that Mike Terzai will be running.
Yeah.
What would be his strengths? I mean, Speaker of the House, but I mean, what would be his strengths?
He's Speaker of the House. He's telling Republicans across the state, like I've been the standard bearer for the Republican agenda for, you know, in leadership. He's been there since 2001. So, and he's been like the lead proponent on liquor privatization. He's big on charters. he's also a prolific fundraiser, and he's done that for Republican members across House members across the state. So he's generated a lot of goodwill with that. And when he's a speaker, he also has to sort of you need like votes from both sides of the aisle. So he has a lot of that backing now, also because he sort of went toe to toe a little bit but he was a big in the budget negotiations when Wolf's first budget, and you know, he's getting credit for kind of halting that.
Yeah, Kevin, I've seen him welcomed as a sort of conquering hero at Republican. Mm-hmm. I'm sure Kevin has too. Yeah. His stance is going up against Wolf on that budget gave him a lot of cachet. Mm-hmm.
Kevin, you mentioned that Scott Wagner might have been Trump before Trump was Trump. But do you think any of these Republican candidates, these other two that we just talked about, were energized by how well Donald Trump did in Pennsylvania in November or not? Mm. Well, any effect? No?
I'm sure they're kind of hoping to keep the energy up, but I'm not really sure if that was a determining factor. I'm sure they were already planning it a while ago before Trump won.
In our remaining 2 minutes, I do want to get to not hearing a lot about strong challengers for Bob Casey yet. We have a couple state representatives, I believe Jim Christiana from Beaver County and Rick Saccone. Mm-hmm. Also from Western Pennsylvania.
Paul Addis is a business.
Yeah, Southeast Paul Addis from the Southeast. That's right, mm-hmm. a businessman from that area.
And Bardos.
Just this morning, Mike Kelly, the congressman representing the 3rd District, came out with a statement that said, I'm not running for governor, because he had been bandied about, but I am very seriously, over the weeks ahead, I'll be very seriously considering a Senate run. And then he said some mean things about Bob Casey. So he would be, I think, the most high-profile person, at least of the field that's in there now. He would be much higher. But it is notable that all three of these guys here are all from the western part of the state. But those are the three, and I would be very much surprised at this point if Mike Kelly does not run. Mm-hmm.
And as you said, he has the highest profile. I mean, highest elected office by far.
Yes,
and a favorite of Donald Trump's as well, an early supporter and a vocal supporter of his.
And there was also some news, and Lou Barletta was kind of floated out there as also a potential
mayor of Hazleton, right?
Yeah, former mayor of Hazleton, now congressman in the I-81 corridor area between Harrisburg and Scranton. But I haven't really heard much since then. That was sort of when all the healthcare voting and stuff like that was going on in Washington. And then also today, I mean, on the incumbent side, Casey got the New York Times treatment too. I don't know if anyone saw that, but they did a profile on him about how he's been more vocal against Trump. And I think that'd be interesting to see how it plays out here, because in 2012, Casey outperformed Obama in the western part of the state. And then, you know, will Trump's continued popularity out here actually, you know, doom Casey or have an impact on his election?
All right, gentlemen, we'll look forward to your continued coverage of what remains of the 17 election and, of course, going into 18. Chris Potter is a reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, and Kevin Zwick is a reporter for the Greensburg Tribune Review. Guys, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Allegheny County has 130 municipalities, a couple dozen with fewer than 2,000 residents. Would it be more cost-effective if they disincorporated? That's next when the Confluence continues on 90.5 WESA.
Here's what's trending in Pittsburgh. I'm Sarah Kovash. New research from Pitt shows that gene editing, that is, removing one gene and replacing it with another, could treat the most aggressive forms of cancer. And Downward Dog, about a talking pup and his owner, premiered this week. The ABC comedy filmed in Pittsburgh had no shortage of Steel City nostalgia, from the Civic Arena to Wiggle Whiskey. Find more of the week's top news at WESA.FM.
It's the Confluence, where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. Look at a map of Allegheny County and the borders of all the different local governments, 130 distinct municipalities in the county, where the total population, about 1.2 million or so. The county executive, Rich Fitzgerald, and his two predecessors released results of a report on allowing municipalities the right to disincorporate. We're going to talk about that with Aaron Opperle, reporter for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review, and Mark Newtbar, senior WESA reporter covering government. Gentlemen, welcome to both of you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for having us on.
If you have a question or comment, tweet us and use the hashtag WESAConfluence. All right. What was the reasoning behind Mark Nordenberg, former Pitt Chancellor, now chair of the University of Pittsburgh's Institute of Politics, to conduct this study? Aaron, we'll start with you.
Well, Pennsylvania is one of only a handful of states that doesn't have a mechanism that allows municipalities to sort of go out of business, to disincorporate. So the state was really good at setting up municipalities. It was a very easy process back in the day. Now, as those municipalities lose population, there's no way for them to not exist. And so I think it was, you know, something that's been around and been talked about. And this group got together and wanted to look at what would that mean for Allegheny County and how would we go about it.
I think it's interesting that all three of the county executives were there. I think it goes back probably before that, if we had some of the county commissioners that still wanted to partake. I'm sure they have stories of communities that should or thought about this.
And Aaron, I want to follow up on a point you made there, that no state law to permit the disincorporation, but there is law that would allow them to, you know, like neighboring ones, to consolidate, to merge, right?
That was really what the state envisioned as the way to solve this problem, was to merge, and you've seen that in some communities. The state also allows for municipalities to disincorporate if they're in Act 47 and can't get out of that and can't find a way to become economically viable. But then the state comes in and they become a ward of the state, and that brings with it some connotation that I think municipalities are pretty terrified of. So this is voluntary. It would be the state, or it'd be the municipality's decision. And under the proposal that Rich Fitzgerald and the group put together, it would be the county that would come in and provide services.
Mark, Aaron used the term ward of the state under, you know, disincorporation under Act 47. But through disincorporation, would they become a ward of the county?
Yeah, pretty much you would become a ward of the county. Your local government would completely dissolve, and the county would take over all of those operations. Now, that doesn't mean that your volunteer fire department goes away, because that is not actually municipal government. It doesn't mean that your library goes away, because that is not actual municipal government. There are a lot of ties, and we can get into that later, but that, you know, that's just one of the complicating factors. But basically, your property taxes, your income tax, would be then sent to the county, and the county would bring back services. It's interesting. What they noted, first of all, is it's better to have a county do that, which is at least a little bit closer than Harrisburg. And also, Allegheny County is the only county that has its own police force. So it is kind of uniquely qualified among the counties in the state to be able to do this.
Not only their own police force, but they also have their own health department. There's already a lot of services that the county is providing to municipalities. And so this would just be a way to build on that and to fund it.
Okay, I mentioned 130 municipalities. I don't know that we even realize how small, in terms of population, a lot of these municipalities are.
Yeah, absolutely. The smallest one, according to the 2010 census, is Hayesville, with 70 people. 70. Others on that kind of small list: Sewickley Heights, 810. Wall, which is one of my favorites, 580.
So, Aaron, there are like about three dozen with populations of 2,000 or fewer residents.
Yeah, and these are municipalities where they're having a hard time getting people to run for the offices that they've created. They can't find people to run for mayor or for their borough council or their township supervisor board. And the question just becomes, is there really a purpose to having that administrative oversight, or would that be better administered by the county?
Okay, I want to talk about the perceived pros and cons of disincorporation, but let's hear from Mark Nordenberg, who called disincorporation another option.
This gives the municipality control over timing and provides a municipality with the opportunity to say, we're heading in the wrong direction, and before things get worse, let's consider what our options are, and this would be one of the options.
All right, gentlemen, you both reported when this study was released by Mr. Nordenberg and the county executives, current and past. Were they saying that there were any cons, or were they all saying only the pros? What are the pros and cons of disincorporation?
I mean, they said this is a very positive thing. And even if you look back at the history of this discussion, I mean, when Frank Locchino came out with a report in 1994 about the same thing, he called it reclaiming hope. And so they, because it's voluntary, they're not going to force anyone to disincorporate. So it's up to the municipality. They really did not talk about any cons to this. That's not to say that municipalities don't see cons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, from an economic side, it makes sense if you can no longer have to hire all of these office holders, not office holders, but all of these different office, you know, the tax collector type person. But there are a lot of details that would have to be worked out. How do you protect the rest of the county taxpayers to make sure that they are not subsidizing what's going on there, and vice versa? How do you know that you're not overcharging the people that live in this unincorporated area for the services that the county is providing? Figuring that out is not going to be easy.
And we went and we talked to some of the communities that might be take advantage of this, and they are so prideful of their community that this wouldn't even be an option for them. Even if they are struggling, they want to pull through and be their own community. So I think the public pride is a huge roadblock here.
Okay. We're talking about disincorporation. Will any of the 130 municipalities in Allegheny County even consider that possibility? With Aaron Opperly, reporter for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review, and Mark Newtbar, senior reporter for WESA covering politics and government. This isn't the first time for proposals about consolidations, mergers, or in this case, disincorporation. Aaron, you brought up Frank Locchino. I believe he was county controller at the
Yes, county controller at the time.
In 94. But also, it was 9 years ago, a 17-month-long study was released recommending the merger of city and county governments. Mark Nordenberg was co-chair of that group. Mark.
Yeah, it didn't do a whole heck of a lot. It kind of went over like a lead balloon, as they say. Just a lot of pushback. People didn't even, I don't think, completely understand how it would work. But there was some movement sort of outside of that idea that maybe was spurred by putting that on the table.
The then, at that time, the then mayor, Luke Ravenstahl, and the then county executive, Dan Honorato, they came out publicly to support it. So why didn't? Wasn't there enough momentum? Or, again, because it was a merger of city and county government, nothing would happen to the other municipalities in the county.
You know, I don't think people were ready for it. Remember, we are not that far removed from having a new form of county government. Why throw that out already? It just takes a lot of cooperation between those two entities. But as I said, there have been some cooperations that have come out of this. We talked about the 911 centers. That is being consolidated slowly. Instead of having every municipality have its own 911, now there is the big county center. That doesn't mean that there aren't some municipalities that still have Ring Down and things of that nature. The software that they use to do personnel is being shared between the county and the city, or at least at last time I checked. So there are some things that are happening.
And I think there's a lot of attention being paid to Wilmerding, which recently contracted with the county for police, and to see how that experiment works out. So far, I talked with the mayor of Wilmerding, and he's extremely excited about it. He said it was awesome. The county seems pleased, too. So seeing these different collaborations and cooperations work out may sort of prime the pump for maybe municipalities to be interested in it.
Interested in disincorporation. But, gentlemen, this would be a long process, disincorporation. And it would start with Harrisburg because you would need enabling legislation, correct?
Yeah, that was my first point, is this has not been passed. This hasn't even been introduced in Harrisburg as of yet. I have not seen sample legislation. I am sure that the Institute of Politics has something, some sort of a framework or model, because they did talk about a few of the specifics. A lot of specifics would have to go into this. Then, as you said, even after that's passed, then your local municipal board would have to vote to have a referendum. Then that referendum would have to be held. And then the county council has to say, yes, we will accept you. And then you still have to work out all the details before it can actually happen.
simple process, Aaron.
Oh, for county government? Yeah. It's something that's not going to happen overnight. There's going to be a lot of forethought. We had Honorado, Roddy, and Fitzgerald in front of the edit board that afternoon at the Tribune Review, and we asked a lot of questions about, community development block grants and other state funding and how would that be worked out. And that's all something that needs to be considered as you move forward with this.
Oh, so other details, more details than just this, quote, simple process of it happening.
Yeah, and watch out for lawsuits if it does happen from somebody in that municipality that will find some reason why this is not legal. One of the first things that I came up with was the uniformity clause, that everybody has to be taxed equally. They say that they can get around it with the way the legislation would be written, but if the county taxes are higher on me than they are on Aaron, that doesn't seem fair.
Well, and Mark brought up the new form of county government, and that barely passed here.
Yes.
It was a few hundred
votes. Nip and
tuck,
yeah.
And so we're talking about a population that is strongly passionate about the way things are and resistance to change in some aspects.
Okay. I spoke with County Executive Rich Fitzgerald this week about this topic, and he says it's not really about going out of business.
Your community doesn't lose its identity. It doesn't lose the churches. It doesn't lose the bakery. It doesn't lose the Little League and all the things that make our neighborhoods special. You may not have an elected mayor or an elected council, if that's something you wish to do, but you still have all the things that make your community special, and that really is the institutions and the people.
So, gentlemen, in your reporting, have you learned whether either the past or current county executives or somebody else has talked to any leaders at the municipal level about this possibility and any sense of reaction, Aaron?
I mean, we talked to a couple of municipal leaders the day the report was released, and a majority of them hadn't even heard of it yet. They hadn't been approached by the county executive, or the discussions hadn't been formal. John Fetterman, the mayor of Braddock, right, had heard of it, and he was very passionate about the fact that he wanted Braddock's rebirth and sort of the rejuvenation there to happen on Braddock's terms and be a part of Braddock. And he was very proud of Braddock's history, its future, its present. So he was against it. Other communities like Wilmerding and Tarentum and Springdale that we were able to get a hold of officials there, they weren't interested. They're proud of what their community does, and they want to keep that moving forward.
So if they heard that message from Rich Fitzgerald that says, we still want to be ourselves?
I think they would say to Rich that it's a big part of who we are, is having our own mayor and our own council and our own police department, and that is part of identity. And if you take that away, then what are we?
Yeah, and having an office that you can walk into if you want to and have somebody to talk to rather than just trying to call up your county councilman who could live three or four, five communities away. I understand what he's saying. I don't think it really plays, especially when you look at a community that has 518 people in it anyway. That's smaller than, many high schools in this area.
In our final minute, what will you guys be looking at on this particular story? Is it going anywhere beyond the release of a study, release of a report? Aaron, we'll start with you.
That's what we're looking for, is to see what happens. We're trying to find out if any communities are interested. Who are they? What are sort of the characteristics there? And then obviously keeping an eye on Harrisburg and seeing what the legislation looks like.
Has anybody even hinted? Did they say, the county executives say that they've got at least a sponsor on board that might introduce this legislation?
They had a few state reps and state senators that were standing there. None of them really wanted to step up and say that they would do it. So at this point, we don't have a name to give you.
They said they have the support of all four caucuses, Republicans, Democrats in the House and the Senate, and that everyone from the Allegheny County delegation is supportive. And what they said to us is that if the Allegheny County delegation is behind it, it has a good chance of passing through Harrisburg. But it would be, you always got to keep an eye and see what happens.
Yeah, I think if it's brought up, it could pass. But it just might not ever be brought up.
All right. Aaron Opperle is a reporter for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. Mark Newtbar, senior WESA reporter covering government. Gentlemen, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The ongoing concerns about lead in the Pittsburgh region, in our water, old homes, soil, that's next on The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
Monarch caterpillars can only eat milkweed plants to survive and turn into butterflies. You can buy milkweed at a local nursery to avoid pesticides or go DIY.
We go out seed collecting like some people go out garage sale shopping. You don't know sometimes what you're going to find, but when you come upon it, it's exciting.
This week on the Allegheny Front, helping monarch butterflies in your garden. Saturday morning at 7:30 on 90.5 WESA.
Support Pittsburgh's independent NPR news station with a vehicle donation. You can find out how at WESA.FM.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, the 1978 Pennsylvania gubernatorial primary results in two candidates from Pittsburgh. Democrat Pete Flaherty from the north side and Republican Dick Thornburgh clinched their respective nominations. Thornburgh would go on to win the election, becoming the 41st governor of the Commonwealth. That's this week's Pittsburgh Almanac for May 19th, 2017.
It's the confluence where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. Concerns over lead, they're not going away. Are they increasing? A call for a moratorium on partial lead line replacements. Creation of a lead advisory task force. Let's talk about these and other developments with Teresa Cliff, reporter for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. Welcome, Teresa. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
And we also welcome into the studio WESA's health and science reporter, Liz Reed. Good to have you, Liz.
Thanks for inviting me downstairs, Kevin.
If you have a question or comment, tweet us and use the hashtag WESAConfluence. Okay, Pittsburgh Water and Sewer Authority, they've been doing partial lead line replacements. How long? About how many, Teresa?
They started, they're entering their third week next week of the partial lead line replacements. They are trying to do about 60 a week, and they started in the Mount Washington area. And also with homes that sent in samples and had high levels. They're going to work their way through other neighborhoods as well.
Are they basing it on those – you mentioned they're basing it on the high levels?
Yeah. They've got, I believe, three contractors. So one of them is looking at the high levels. The other two are going by council district, starting with Mount Washington.
And that's not to say that they haven't done partial lead replacements in the past. This is just the beginning of what they're calling like a blitz. Of replacements. And so part of the reason why they have to sort of step up the pace here is state law or state regulations mandate that if a water system exceeds that 15 parts per billion in their compliance testing, that they have to replace 7% a year. So that now applies, or since last summer, that applies to PWSA.
Right. And in the past, they were mostly just replacing the lead lines when they were doing repairs to the line, and they won't come across a lead line, they'd replace it. But now they're going out specifically to do the partial replacements. And it's controversial because they are stopping at the part of the line that is privately owned.
Right.
And under the EPA mandate that they have to replace the 7%, as you mentioned, the EPA prefers they do full line replacements, but as I'm sure we'll get into later, PWSA says that they believe there's a state law that prohibits them from doing that. So they're doing partial, which is what County Controller Chelsea Wagner calls for a halt for.
A quick follow-up. Both of you mentioned the 7%. Is there any indication they're trying to exceed that and actually do more? Is it, okay, we got to do 7, we're going to do 7? Do we know?
I mean, I know as in January, Bob Weimer, one of the leaders of PWSA, it was either Bob Weimar or Bernard Lindstrom, I don't remember off the top of my head, but at a community meeting, they said in 2016, in that second half of 2016, they were already behind. So it's possible they may be trying to make up for falling behind last year, but I don't know for sure if they're actually trying to exceed the 7% for this year.
Okay, so this week, Controller Chelsea Wagner called for a moratorium on the partial lead line replacements, saying they can be more dangerous than doing nothing. She says it loosens the lead that can get more of the lead into the water. It seems to be that there is a difference, or at least not agreed upon – determination about if it indeed increases lead in the water, how much, how long it would take to get that out. Is that correct, Teresa?
I spoke to Peter Gravatt. He's the EPA's head of drinking water, and he did say that the reason they prefer full line replacements is because the partial does get more lead in the water. It depends on a lot of things, whether that's just for a few weeks or a few months, or I've heard even it could be a few years. But that is something that's commonly stated by scientists that does happen.
And go ahead, Liz.
Yeah, and just to quote an EPA report answering that question, these partial line replacements, quote, have not been shown to reliably reduce drinking water lead levels in the short term, ranging from days to months and potentially even longer. So it is really open-ended, and it doesn't sound like there's been sort of like long enough studies looking at the lead levels over a sustained period of time to actually really know.
Okay. Go ahead, Teresa.
I was just going to add on that the EPA requires a couple things for water authorities that do the partial. Like they have to give 40 days notice to the homeowner. They have to test the water within 72 hours of doing the partial replacement again. And PWSA is saying that they are doing those things.
But Chelsea Wagner said that they're not in
the
press conference.
Yeah, it's all about he said, she said. But there are confirmed dangers with doing the partial. It's just unclear how long those can last.
Okay. So Wagner wants full replacement of the lines, which is recommended by EPA. PWSA and the mayor say, well, the public can't pay for the replacement of lines into the house, from the curb into the house. Senator Wayne Fontana has proposed legislation. What does it say?
So the bill would modify Title 53 of the Pennsylvania Consolidated Statutes to specifically allow authorities to spend money on private property to replace private lead service lines. It's very specific about what would be authorized. What's interesting about this bill is that there's no strike through. So sort of a quick primer, if you've ever read the text of a bill in the State House before, whatever's proposed to be removed from the current statute will have a strike through it in the text of the bill. Whatever is being added is underlined. So in this particular bill, the new text is underlined, but no existing text is to be removed. So that made me wonder if the current statute explicitly prohibits the spending of public money in this way. And so far, I haven't gotten a definitive answer, but I emailed Kevin Acklin, who is Mayor Peduto's chief of staff and the chief development officer for the city, and he said, quote, the matter's been decided by the court. So I'm actually waiting to hear from the PWSA solicitor. Maybe you know more about this, about what that case law says.
I'm not sure on the case law, but like you, I haven't actually been able to find the state law that PWSA often says there's the state law that prohibits this of replacing the private side. They sometimes cite the Municipality Authorities Act.
Right.
Which is not actually the act that Fontana's bill would modify.
Right. That's why it's confusing.
It
is. And I have talked to the Pennsylvania Municipality Association. They said that language is not in the Municipalities Act. So it's unclear if there even is such a law. It might be, like you said, a court decision.
Yeah, we're waiting to hear more about the case law. And then so what we know about the current statute is that it doesn't explicitly prohibit, but it also doesn't specifically allow authorities to spend that money.
It's
so
silent.
It is a little bit tricky.
So would Fontana's legislation, if it's passed, just say, okay, it solves that question of that ambiguity?
From my understanding, it would just provide clarity that this is definitely allowed. Philadelphia is doing full-line replacements, and so is York, but it gets complicated because York is a private water system.
And Philadelphia is a first-class city.
So it's unclear what the law is that they're citing.
I want to get into lead beyond water in a moment or so, but one more about water. And politicians seem to be going back and forth. Is somebody downplaying the seriousness of the situation, or others overdoing it, calling it a public health crisis? Here's Mayor Peduto at a WESA mayoral forum just last week.
If you talk with local experts, they'll tell you that, yes, lead in the water is a concern, but the level that we have is no different than 5,330 other systems.
Is that a bit misleading, vague? How would you characterize that statement?
Yeah.
Teresa.
So after that forum that you just played, I reached out to his office and asked that question. I actually sent him a tweet also to an account that I was told he mans. He responded with a CNN article where he got that 5,300 figure. That figure is actually talking about the number of water systems in the country that don't test properly. It's not about the actual amount of lead in the water. So I haven't heard him use that figure since. And I spoke to our City Hall reporter, Bob Bowder. He said he hasn't either. So maybe he's stopped. But yeah, it's not actually the correct. There's about, I talked to someone at the EPA also on this, and they said to look at, to sort of answer that question of how many water systems in the country have this kind of problem. They said to look at ones that serve over 100,000. PWSA, if you count the folks that are here to work during the day, serves over 500,000. There's about 7 or 8 other systems in the country that serve over that amount that are in exceedance. And the only larger one is Portland, Oregon. So,
you know, and I think also, like, knowing that other cities maybe are facing the same challenges doesn't make it, isn't necessarily going to make the residents of Pittsburgh feel better, especially people who know they have lead lines or suspect that they have lead lines. I mean, if everyone else's house is on fire, it doesn't make you less upset that your own house is on fire. So I'm not sure quite, you know, I don't know what was going through his mind or what point he was trying to make with that figure.
Okay. We have just a few minutes left. I want to quickly, County Executive Rich Fitzgerald, earlier this month appointed a lead advisory council. What does he want to get out of this? Is this just reactive or what?
Yeah, that came, after a few media reports and, it's not clear. They're going to look at whether the data that the county has is right, and they're going to look at possible policy changes for their lead. I asked whether that could include imposing penalties on landlords that have lead in rental properties where children live with confirmed lead levels. They said that could be a possibility, but they're not really saying right now what specific policies that they're looking into.
Yeah, at this point, it seems pretty broad.
Okay.
A broad mandate.
2 minutes to go. And we talked a lot about politicians and policies and laws. Let's talk about who is affected people. The policies affect people. Children, renters, homeowners who can't afford to replace the lead lines beneath their homes. As you've talked to people when you've covered any of these lead stories, what are you hearing? Tell us what you've heard. Quickly, Teresa.
Yeah, a lot of people are just really confused. They don't have the money to replace the private side of the line.
Is there somebody particularly stood out to you, their story?
Yeah, I spoke with a woman who lives in a Section 8 home in Rankin, whose daughter had a confirmed lead level of 9, which is just under the level to get a county home inspection. And she didn't have the funds to go out and get that herself. So she's sort of just left wondering what the lead's coming from, how to fix it, whether she needs to replace the line, whether her landlord is going to pay to do that. It can be pretty upsetting as a parent.
I mean, I would just echo that. I think people are seeking clarity, and in some cases, they're seeking financial assistance.
Well, the question is, we've been talking about this. You've been reporting on this. Is there any more clarity now than there was a few months ago, or not? Are we still very? Is it still very ambiguous?
I think one thing that is promising is the filter program. From what I can see, that is a step that is showing that they at least take it somewhat seriously. I haven't come across a whole lot of other water systems in the country that are handing out free filters. But as far as what is this problem, how big is this problem, there's still a lot of questions.
Something tells me you two are going to be reporting on this for quite some time.
Probably, yeah.
All right. Teresa Clift is a reporter for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. Liz Reed is health and science reporter for WESA. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you. Thanks.
And for this time, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. The engineer for the program is Tom Hurley. Production assistance this week from Katie Blackley. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good week of good news.